This episode is all about fundraising in Israel and the United States, precision oncology, machine learning, and deep RNA analysis. In this episode, I have a conversation with Tuvik Becker. He is the CEO of Pangea Biomed and has started, developed, and exited companies in the United States and Israel. Now he is developing Pangea Biomed to start the next revolution in precision oncology.
Nothing is impossible. But I think another very important factor is the way this area welcomes immigration and many U.S. investors would only invest in U.S. companies. Thought and emphasis, especially by budding entrepreneurs, is having a wide funnel. You really have to start with talking to many, many, many. Do be mentally ready to have 100 or more meetings in order to get this one initial check. And Pangea's whole approach focuses on harnessing these expression abnormalities in order to attack cancer cells and spare normal, healthy cells. So Enlight is able to create biomarkers for completely novel drugs or for drugs that are already that already exist but have only been tried on a handful of patients so far.
Tuvik Becker is a seasoned entrepreneur, an experienced executive, and a strong technical leader who spent the last 20 years building, scaling, and leading companies in the healthcare, financial, and aerospace domains. Prior to his role with Pangea, he co-founded Medware Limited and now serves as its executive chairman. Tuvik holds a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics from Tel Aviv University and a PhD in computational neuroscience from the Hebrew University. He is also a member of 8400, the Health Network. Founded in 2018, Pangea Biomed is an Israeli biotech startup redefining cancer care. The company developed Enlight, the world's most advanced multi-cancer, multi-therapy response predictor. By combining machine learning and deep RNA analysis, the company is mapping tumor molecular signatures to dynamically and adaptively personalize cancer care for a healthier world. Pangea aims to bring effective precision oncology to cancer patients, improve oncology drug development, and empower oncologists to treat patients with success. Pangea is backed by NFX, and its technology has been published in leading journals, including Cell, Science Advances, Cancer Cell, and Nature Communications. In this episode, we talk about the startup ecosystem in Israel, fundraising in the United States from 2000 to 2022, three success secrets to fundraising in the United States, Pangea's Enlight technology, and precision oncology. Enjoy the show. The stream gets corrupted, so I started recording on the Zoom server, on YouTube, and also on my computer.
Okay.
It would be a pity that if we find out after the conversation that they have no footage. So
we'll do it again, no problem. It will be interesting to compare.
Oh yeah. This would be interesting. It's good to see you, Tuvik. Do I spell your name right, Tuvik Becker?
Tuvik Becker. Yeah, that's right. Spelling and right pronunciation. Thanks, Christian. It's really great to be here with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
It's good to have you here. I heard from your company in San Diego at the bio, and initially I thought you are US-based. I had a look at your website, and it's Pangea Biomed. And there is maybe, I can put it up and can show you directly. Here's the share screen option. So I was on your website and it's really well done. It's a great website. I like the structure. I mean, it looks to me like you put the entire pitch deck on the website in a very logical and well-designed structure. And when I scrolled down, I saw Massachusetts General Hospital, USC, University of Southern California, National Cancer Institute, MD Anderson. And the first thought I had in my mind was that you are US-based. But you aren't. Where are you currently?
So currently I'm in Tel Aviv, and Pangea is based in Israel. It was founded in Israel. And it's true that a lot of our activity is actually in the US and hopefully in the near future in Europe as well, because we definitely are looking for collaborations in Europe. There's a lot of activity in our space in Europe.
So I misspelled the name of your company, obviously. It's Pangea or Pangea.
Well, it depends. In English, we call it Pangea. In Hebrew, it's Pangea, but Pangea is perfect.
How did you come up with the name of your company?
Well, that's you know, Pangea is the primordial, all-encompassing continent. It had something to do with the fact that when we try to find solutions for cancer, when we try to find vulnerabilities for tumors, we have to adopt a holistic approach. So we look for terms that would be something holistic and all-encompassing, and Pangea sounded right, so we liked it.
That's a great thing. You started your company in Israel, not in the United States. When I look at Israel from the countryside, I think Israel has about 10 million inhabitants, but correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. So it's similar size than, like, for example, Switzerland or Hungary or Austria in Central Europe. But when I look at the ecosystem, at the startup ecosystem, it's quite interesting because it looks to me it's of similar size like Silicon Valley, for example, in the United States. I see so many companies coming out of Israel. And the interesting thing for me to learn or to hear from you is why is that? What's your opinion? Why is Israel so strong in creating startups?
Well, it's a very good question. I think I'm by no means an expert on the topic. A lot has been written about it, and there are people who have devoted their careers to studying this phenomenon and really analyzing it. But I can give my very personal perspective on why Israel is such a successful startup hub and startup community, and I think some of it has to do with a pretty deep cultural traits in Israeli society. So one thing I think which is quite fundamental in Israeli behavior and education, etc., is contrarianism, and it has very deep roots even in the religious thinking and the way the Bible is taught and interpretations of the Bible are taught. There's a deep trend of argumentation, so you have to present opposing views and argue the question rather than accept a doctrine. And I think this goes on to these days, and Israeli schools are pretty unruly places where you're not supposed to accept what the teacher is telling you, but rather to be critical, to raise questions, to engage in a discussion. And I think this is really essential for any startup, because there are so many unknowns. You have to be very skeptical. You have to be asking questions all the time and checking yourself, because what was true yesterday may not be true today any longer. So I think this is one thing which is very helpful.
Is it really that way that the kids in school are welcomed and invited to challenge the views of the teachers? Did I understand it right?
Yes, you did. It can turn the classroom into a rather unruly place at times. But at least in the good schools, it definitely is a welcome attitude, and there's a lot of teaching of critical thinking and debating, etc.
And the teacher doesn't have a possibility to cancel the kids, to just say, so you're out. So
the possibility exists, but it's reserved for extreme situations, of course. It's not, you know, just because you raise an opposing view, that would probably not happen. If you're doing it, you know, if you're disturbing the class, that's something else. But if you're just saying, mm-hmm. well, it seems to me that there's another explanation, for example, or I heard an opposing view, that this is definitely welcome.
So the kids have to learn in school then very early to bring up their own point of view, but also to back their point of view with evidence. So it's not just that they can say, okay, teacher, you are wrong. I have the right opinion. So they also need to learn then to do proper research, to find material and to discuss on a more adult level. Is that the right mm-hmm. perception?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that is definitely the ideal. It's not always real life, but in terms of the culture, it's definitely there. And, mm-hmm. You know, arguing is very natural for Israelis. Another thing which is quite deeply imbued in Israel is the feeling that nothing is impossible. Okay. In the IDF, in the Israeli military, this is a very, very strong trait or notion that is being taught. As you know, that there are many elite technological units, and this really applies very strongly there. So often, young soldiers who just come out of high school, very talented, are faced with extreme challenges, extreme technological challenges. Not only that, of course, you have the physical challenges, you have other ones, but I think it's especially interesting that young people are faced with really demanding challenges, and the notion is, there's no such thing as impossible. You can do it. Find a way to do it. And with team spirit, you can often overcome things that would otherwise seem impossible. And I've personally seen that happen many, many times, that, you know, if you don't know, or if you don't think, if you don't come with the superstition or with the presupposition that something is impossible, it is in fact doable, and it even happened to me in the past. That's a separate story. I think that the third factor that comes into this success as a startup community also has to do to some extent with the compulsory military service, and it's the fact that the army brings together people from all of Israel, from different backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, and it creates situations where you have to work as teams, and this creates really closely knit social circles, and it is quite common in Israeli startups that you see a startup being established by a team from the army. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a team that work together in a technological unit. Oftentimes it's a combat team where after the army service, everyone went their own way. And one became a marketing person and another became a technology expert, etc. But then when one of them has an idea, they come together as a team because they have this background. They know how to work together as a team. And this often leads to pretty good startup teams. So, I'm not sure these are the three most important factors or that they explain a lot of the phenomenon, but these are definitely observations that I had for why Israeli startups are relatively common and relatively successful.
No, makes sense to me. It sounds very reasonable. I mean, the first one, if I should give it a title, it would be the search for truth. So in school, that to encourage kids to learn more and to always find out what's true and what's not true, which only can evolve through conversation. The second point was also great. The attitude in the army that nothing is impossible, so that you can achieve basically anything. I think it's very encouraging. And I also agree to the third point that you made, the military service. Do I remember that right? I think it's 2 years in Israel, and it's every young Israeli has to join the army.
It's actually 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, that's the minimum for women. The minimum is 2 years, but it's often longer. So kids who want to go to any elite unit would normally subscribe for a longer term service. They want to become officers, they would serve longer. If they want to serve in a technological role, they would sometimes learn initially and then serve longer. So yeah, it's a very significant period in every young person's life in Israel.
So it's 36 months. I mean, my service in Austria was 6 months, so it was a little bit shorter. But I had a conversation recently with Tobias Silverzahn from McKinsey. We talked about habits and lifestyle habits that are important for entrepreneurs. And it reminded me of my time in the military. And what we were talking about, for example, was why we need sleep. So why sleep is so important for mental health and especially for entrepreneurs then. Another thing we were talking about was discipline, habits, or nutrition. And it reminded me of my time in the army that these were basically the basic skills that were taught at the army during service. So to get up at 6 a.m. in the morning, to follow a certain plan throughout the day, to complete tasks and not leave tasks open, to exercise, to train. And when you say that basically every Israeli has to attend 36 months the army, I think this is then just the basic lifestyle that people learn over 3 years. And maybe that also influences then the attitude in a startup. Would you see it similarly, or did I miss something?
No, I definitely think so. It's really hard to overestimate the influence that the army service has on all aspects of Israeli society, and these are definitely some of the ways in which it does.
I'm curious about the next point. So there's a lot of training in Israel that basically fosters entrepreneurship thinking. How is it to found a company in Israel? Can we maybe walk it through and take your company as an example? What are the steps that you need to take?
Yeah. So by now it's not my first or second or even third company. So I'm not sure that would be the best example, but going back into my first time as an entrepreneur, it's actually been something very natural. First of all, you see a lot of people around you who do that. So entrepreneurship is pretty common. Many of your friends do that, or older people that you know do that. So I think that lowers the bar for deciding to become an entrepreneur. Sometimes it lowers it too much, so it seems less of no one really prepares you for how hard it really is not so much to start a company, that's the easy part, but to have a thriving company, which is really something pretty hard. As I said, it's relatively easy to come up with an idea and then gather a group of friends that would spend some time with you on this crazy idea of yours. And basically, right after the military service, so that's usually the age of 21, 22, often people go on a long long tour around the world right after the military service. So early 20s is a time when many Israeli youngsters come up with some idea and then they gather some friends and let's start a company around that. And of course, then it's time to raise some money. So people go and talk to investors, talk to angel investors, talk to VCs. Often the first money comes from friends and family or small angel investors. And then if the idea really holds water and continues to develop, you need to seek more institutional investment, etc. So I don't think there's one path, there's one way to do it, but it's just a pretty common thing to do, and many people try it. Most try it once and do not succeed and then move on to do other things. But some really get hooked on this this lifestyle, this direction, and do it over and over again.
I was smiling while you were talking. It reminded me of my first try into the startup world. It was a military startup. It was a spin-off from Novartis, which was funded from the first day with VC money because the let's call it the founder of the department in Novartis was Rutger Novak, who then later on founded CRISPR Therapeutics. Mm-hmm. And when I talked with my friends here in Austria, when we all exchanged information, what we are doing professionally, and they said, I'm in a new company. And they said, what? Why are you throwing your life away? Why don't you go to the industry and work in a real company? So it was 2006, so it was a long way back. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. the situation has changed, and a lot of money from the government was invested to foster a startup ecosystem here in Austria. And I think Vienna in life science has become a startup hub in Europe. How is the situation in Israel? Are there similar hubs in Israel that or regions in Israel that are famous for fostering the startup ecosystem?
Sure, there are quite a few. So Tel Aviv is obviously the biggest and most dense startup hub. There are hundreds of successful startups and probably thousands of aspiring startups in the Tel Aviv area alone. There are significant startup hubs in Jerusalem and also in the Galilee. There's a lot of biotech and health tech going on in the Galilee, in Yokneam, in Komiel, small towns in the northern part of Israel, and also in the south, in the desert around Ben Gurion University in Beersheba. There's a lot of activity. So, you know, I would say that every big university sprouts innovation, and around them you would find people with bright new ideas that want to translate that from basic science into technology, into products, into something that would make a difference in the world. So, you know, it's not like there's one hub, but it's really wherever there's a good university, there's also a lot of startup activity.
Sounds like the whole country. I'm always impressed by the entrepreneurs in Tel Aviv. The pictures I saw from Tel Aviv remind me always of Barcelona. So beautiful beach and great summer, great environment for not working. So I'm always impressed that the entrepreneurs then basically sit down. I would rather go to the desert. So it's basically when I want to work, get something done. How is life in Tel Aviv?
Well, I really love Tel Aviv. I spent around 7 years in the U.S. First in California, in Palo Alto, Stanford, and then in the Midwest, and I loved both places a lot. But coming back to Tel Aviv was really wonderful, because I think the combination of a true city that's alive 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, so a big metropolitan area with a nice warm sea. It's quite unique that you don't find that combination in many places. And for people who grew up close to the sea, I think it's hard to live very far away from it. Or also, I found it hard to be in Northern California and be so close to the sea, but still not be able to swim or to enjoy swimming anyway, because the sea is too cold. So I think it's kind of an ideal combination in that respect. Not in other respects. I don't like the weather in Israel in the summer, except for the sea. It's hot, it's humid in the Tel Aviv area, but you know, you can't have it all. So overall, I think quality of life in Tel Aviv is really high. So lots of culture, lots of excellent food, a lot of fun, and of course, many good options for doing great work. So the talent pool is really wonderful. It's next to none in the world, from my own experience.
I think if I was in Tel Aviv, I would probably do all my meetings at the beach, so having coffee and inviting people. And
we do that. We do that pretty often. So there are many meetings at the beach and in cafes. If you see the cafes in Tel Aviv, it looks like no one ever works, because they are always full. And what are all these people doing here? Why are they not in the office working? But yeah, there's a lot of work going on in cafes and on the beach and in the parks, etc. So yeah, it's a lively and lovely environment, I think.
You mentioned before that you spent 7 years at Stanford in Palo Alto. How is life in Palo Alto in California?
I spent three and something years in Palo Alto, and then another 3.5 years in the Midwest. And as I said, I love both places. Life in Palo Alto is unique. So first of all, I think Palo Alto has the perfect weather. I never was in a place with better weather than Palo Alto. It has this magical microclimate that's always nice, almost. But of course, it with Stanford and with Berkeley across the bay, it's an amazing place for good science, and it's an amazing place for entrepreneurship and in terms of funding opportunities. Israel can only dream of the funding opportunities that are available in Silicon Valley. So you can do everything bigger and faster. On the other hand, that the competition for talent is very fierce, and cost of living is very high, etc. So you know, it's always a balance. But I would definitely recommend to any entrepreneur to spend some time in Silicon Valley, or in Palo Alto is one of the best places probably to understand the way it's done there, because there's a lot to learn from it.
Let me ask you one question about Palo Alto, your opinion. I mean, we have an entire planet with many countries, many cultures, many cities, many universities. but the area around Stanford seems to stand out in entrepreneurship globally. So I think there is nothing comparable to Silicon Valley. And when I was a student, it was in the 90s in Austria, I think it always looked to me that Europe is at par with the United States. So back in the 90s, 80s, 70s, when we look at invention and entrepreneurship and development also of larger corporations, I think back then also a lot of inventions came from Europe. Mobile, for example, mobile industry, Europe mm-hmm. played an important part in that. And then suddenly it changed. I mean, I think with the 2000s, early 2000s, Silicon Valley simply took off, and no region, in my opinion, is comparable to Silicon Valley. Do you have a theory why that happened? What's your opinion on that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Well, I think, again, I am no expert and I'm only giving my personal opinions, but one thing which is quite obvious is just the amount of money that's available, that's seeking novel breakthrough ideas to back. But I think another very important factor is the way this area welcomes immigration and foreign innovation. I felt it personally when I was a foreigner in Silicon Valley, and I came to California in 2002. This was after the dot-com bubble burst, and it was still very, very hard to raise money at that time. And yet we were able to do that. We were quite persistent in our attempts. We met with lots and lots of investors until we found one. It was Labrador Ventures, and I would always cherish their welcoming approach. And it was nice to be clearly a foreigner and yet accepted and trusted. So I think this openness to innovation by foreigners, by people who come from other countries, is important, because many studies who looked at the sources of innovation, a lot of it is coming from immigrants. I think that this is one of the contributing factors, and I believe that the Silicon Valley is quite unique in this respect.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, don't know very well the situation in the United States, but in Europe, looking at life science after Series A, I would say it's really tough and challenging to raise large rounds here in Europe. So the usual way for European companies is simply to sell everything to industrial partners and start from scratch. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is anything comparable to the US capital market in mm-hmm. Europe or anywhere in the world. I'm curious, you said you tried the first time to raise funds in the United States in 2002. So right after the dot-com bubble burst. Let's dig a little bit deeper into fundraising in the United States. How was it for you in 2002 to go where no man went before after the dot-com bubble burst?
Well, it was very hard. It took a lot of determination and pretty thick skin to get lots and lots of rejections before someone decided to take the risk and back us and invest in what we did. And it was a tremendous learning experience, not just the fundraising, of course, but the whole experience of that first company. It really taught me a lot and shaped everything I've done since then to an extent. So as I said, I think it's a period that's very beneficial, and I would definitely recommend spending some time there.
I believe that many European companies want to raise funds in the United States. Could you give a walkthrough? What you recommend? How they should approach the US market? Is it just get a ticket to San Francisco and then go into the next bar and you will find only investors there? Or
no, I don't think so. I don't think that's the way it is. First of all, I think it's hard for foreign companies, which is different from foreign entrepreneurs, hard for foreign companies to raise money in Silicon Valley. So many US investors would only invest in US companies. So my company back in 2002, it was a US company. It was started in Silicon Valley and it raised local money, although the entrepreneurs were foreign. Going to the US to raise money for a European company or for an Israeli company for that matter is much trickier than relocating to the US for a few years, starting a company there and raising money. Of course, this is more difficult from different aspects. Not everyone is willing to relocate, but in terms of raising the money, it's much, much easier to do it for a local company. And some investors are really extreme in that sense. They only invest within their metropolitan area. So I've heard from several investors who said, I'm not investing in any company where I cannot go into my car and visit their offices within 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So really restrictive, and many investors like to really have that immediacy of contact with the companies that they invest in. I think in Israel, it's somewhere in between, because many of the big VCs have branches in Israel that are making investments in the Israeli ecosystem. And this could probably be replicated in Europe, and I'm sure it is. I just don't know enough about the VC ecosystem in Europe, but I'm sure that from the little I know, you have that as well. So that is of course one way of doing that.
I'm not so sure. You said that the big VCs in the United States have branches in Israel. So they have their offices and they invest directly also in Israel.
Yes, that they do. So sometimes it's a really separate entity with their own mandate. Sometimes it's just partners that are local to Israel, and the decisions are made together at an investment committee in the US. It really depends. There are several different models, but many US VCs have realized that there's a lot of innovation going on in Israel, and it would be good to diversify investments and have local teams here. So that's one way of getting to US money in Israel. It's not exactly the same. So if you look at valuations in Israel and in the US, there is still a gap. So the same VC you can see a gap in the valuation given to Israeli companies versus ones in the US. And there's also logic behind that, because go-to-market is different when you're away. So there are many factors who would affect that. But it's definitely a good way to allow money to flow more globally.
No, definitely. I didn't hear something like that from other European hubs, but maybe I missed also something. I would say comparable probably is United Kingdom, London area. But in Austria, I'm not aware of US VCs having their offices in Austria. We would be very happy. When I look at fundraising in the United States, what you learned in the last 20 years, could you sum it up into three success secrets?
frankly, no. no, I don't think I could sum it up into success secrets, but I can probably give some points which I found important. The first point, which is I think it's trivial and it's a cliche, and yet it's often not given sufficient thought and emphasis, especially by budding entrepreneurs, is having a wide funnel. You really have to start with talking to many investors if you want to eventually succeed in raising money. You have to meet lots and lots of people. Most people wouldn't invest in your idea, even if it's perfect, even if it's the best idea in the world, you know, for many different reasons. And you know, the big funds have their anti-portfolios, all the investment opportunities that they miss, and some of them are famous for publicizing that. So it doesn't mean your idea is bad if you get many rejections.
Can we state the funnel level a little bit? Very often when I speak with founders here in Europe, it looks to me, from the expectation side, it looks to me like they expect to have 5 meetings and get the investments done. When you say you have to talk with many VCs, many investors until you get one to invest in your company, can we nail it down with a number? How many conversations do you think you need to have to get one investor? Is it 5 conversations or is it 10 conversations?
Yeah, okay. So that's not the right order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. So I think if it's your first time as an entrepreneur, be prepared to talk to over 100 investors before you get an investment. And with my first company, our roster of investors that we actually met with, we had more than 120 meetings before we got an investment. So it's true, these were really tough times. But then again, right now we are also in a bit of rough times. We are in something that does look like a downturn after two quite spectacular years for entrepreneurship and for VC funding. If it's your first time, if you don't know personally many investors, if you don't yet have a reputation as someone who's done this course successfully in the past, you would need to meet with many investors to secure funding. Later on, you can, of course, get it more quickly and with less effort. And of course, there are those super successful entrepreneurs that when they only start a new company, investors are fighting for the chance to invest in their new business, but that's a very select elite
I completely agree. After building your first Tesla, probably it's not very difficult to raise money when Elon Musk goes on the market and say to another company. Before, probably it's difficult. I completely agree to what you say. So we have the first success secret. We expect to get a lot of rejections mm-hmm. and speak to many VCs and don't give up. I would say when we put the number on it, expect more than 100 first meetings to get one investment.
Yeah, I would say that's a good rule of thumb. Hopefully you'd get it earlier, but do be mentally ready to have 100 or more meetings in order to get this one initial check. By the way, once you have a lead, it's often much easier to get follow-on investors. So there are many who would like your idea but wouldn't have the confidence to set terms for a round because they don't feel they have sufficient expertise. But if someone else with more expertise in the field would come in and set terms, then they would be willing to join. So really focus on lead investors. Meet with others, always build the funnel for follow-on investment, but focus on the leads. And I think that the second thing you have to keep in mind is prepare for the meetings and know what the investors that you're going to meet are looking for. Okay, so it's very, very important to understand where they're coming from, what's their investment philosophy, what they are looking to invest in, and see if there's a fit. If there's no fit a priori, maybe it's a waste of their time and a waste of your time. So try to concentrate on investors who really are interested in what you're doing, and then try to have good answers to meet their areas of interest. So I think that's the second thing, and if you press me for a third.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I would say that at least for me personally, it's been important to not be afraid and admit what's still unknown. Okay, because a startup company is I always think about it as a ship sailing in uncharted territory and drawing the map as it goes. So you have a new idea, and if it's really an idea with at least a grain of true novelty, there will be questions which have not yet been answered, and you'll have to ask the right questions and find the answers as you go. So you have to strike a good balance. On one hand, you have to convince your investors that you have a clear path forward. Okay, you have thought out well the details of what you're going to do in the next 12 to 24 months, let's say, mm-hmm. and what's your offering is going to look like, et cetera, and how you're going to pass certain hurdles which are sure to be on your way in the short to midterm. But then again, it's only natural that there would be questions to which you do not yet have the answers. That's just the nature of the beast. And I think it's important to admit that, to admit your limitations in terms of what you still don't know. Because if you can ask the right questions, if you can draw the map and also say, here I have a blank area, I don't yet know. We'll have to get good answers to these two, three questions within 6 months because these are important for our next steps. But right now, we just don't know. Okay, I think that's a very, very credible approach. And it instills more confidence to come up with this approach than try to pretend that you know everything in advance, because that just... usually it's not true, and it leads to catastrophes. If you try to stick to your theory when you still don't have sufficient information, That's not a good recipe for success. So know enough to move forward, but don't be afraid to admit what you still don't know.
Yeah, I think there was a big example recently in California. I forgot the name. It was in diagnostics. Was a huge blow up. Theranos. It was
Theranos. Not so recent any longer, but yeah, of course, yeah. Theranos was an infamous example, which has tainted the whole industry for a long time, and I think we're still recovering from the effects of that ordeal.
And I think this showing that there are gaps and that there are things that the team don't know is also the reason for VCs to invest in the company in the first place. So if everything is already sorted out, especially in life science, why should a VC then invest in a company? So it's except it kept scaling, but we are talking now about pre-seed, seed, Series A. And as far as I know from my European experiences, VCs invest in that company to help the company get to the next step and create data along the way. So this is their investment plan. So I think it's a great approach that you recommend, being open with the reality.
Yeah, and in general, I think in building a relationship with your investors, with your board, with everyone, any stakeholder in the company, sincerity is really a top importance. It's the one most important thing to bear in mind. You must be absolutely frank and open. And if there are difficulties, you have to convey them clearly. Of course, chart a way forward. Say how you're going to overcome the difficulties, but never try to hide the difficulties, because that's really a recipe for disaster.
What matters to me most in businesses are relationships, basically. And I think lying is something that definitely harms the relationship and makes it more difficult to engage in anything in future. How do you rate relationships? What's your experience with building relationships during fundraising? Do they matter, or are they not so important? Is it more transactional?
No, I think it's the most important. I totally agree with you. I think it's the most important thing, not only with investors, it also internally in terms of team building. I think the most important thing to do is build a team which is cohesive, which has strong relationship, where people really try to help each other rather than compete with each other internally, because it's very, very hard to succeed as a startup. Competition is extremely fierce, and things are very dynamic. So you might be on a roll one day, and 2 months later you're really in deep trouble. Something comes up and you have challenges you didn't even dream about, etc. And you have to be able to survive those ups and downs, and they all take a psychological toll. So it's extremely important to build a strong team. And this is true for the employees, for everyone in the company, and it's true also for the relationship with the board and with the investors. So it's important that everyone is together. We're all in the same boat, and we are transparent, and we are in it together. And your investors really want you to succeed. Once they wrote the check, they're with you. And it's extremely important to align interests with your investors. So think about it all the time. You want to have the same interests between founders, employees, investors. All have to be aligned and working towards a common goal. Of course, easier said than done. There are forces that would always create some some misalignment, some conflicts of interest, but these should be minimized to the max as much as possible.
That's true. Aligning interests, I think, is also very important. I had in the recording 3 weeks ago, the podcast is already live, with Donna Lavoie. She consults life science entrepreneurs in how they should present their company to investors and to industrial partners. And she showed the Vertex Pharma pitch deck from the early days and the title page. And there was the clear statement, we want to build a pharma company. So we want to make something big. And I know from Europe, for example, there are VCs on the market who don't want that. They just want to invest in a single asset company, move it one step forward, and then sell the technology very quickly to the pharma industry. And when the entrepreneurs and the founders don't address that early on, they risk ending up in a situation where one side wants to build something similar to Vertex. And on the other hand, maybe they find investors who don't want that. And then it becomes really tricky to move this forward.
Right, right. And I think it's really hard to resist the temptation to tell investors what they want to hear. Because sometimes you meet an investor and you have your plan. You want to build your big company, and they seem to want something that would sell quickly. And I think you have to make that tough choice. Either you convince them to go with your vision, or you're willing to forego your ambitions and go with what they want. But it just usually won't work if you take their money and you hold on to what you wish to do, which is contrary to their goals and incentives. That would lead to strong misalignment, and it, there would be trouble down the way, and it's better to avoid it from the beginning and just try to find investors that you will be aligned with, and because otherwise you are funding your company, but you're priming it for failure down the road. So why waste those next 2 years just to meet frustration when it's if and when you are successful? That's really a shame. So spend another 3 months or 5 months on finding investors that you are aligned with, or just face reality and change your expectations to match those of your investors. But if you can be okay with that.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think especially when it comes to values and beliefs, also from the entrepreneur side, I mean, if it's really a calling in an entrepreneur like Jeff Bezos, for example, with Amazon, to at least try to give it a shot, to try to build something big, I doubt that it's so easy to change without significant failure in between. So to just give it up and say, okay, now I switch. If it's something that's not a value, for example, okay, I don't want to move to San Francisco. Maybe it can be overcome. So move to San Francisco. Why not? I mean, you get money there. It's no problem. And when you don't find one in Vienna, also with the VCs, I think when they have it encoded in their DNA already that they just don't fund IPOs, so that they want to sell it. It's also very difficult to change that or to make them change. So putting that on the table early on, I think this is the success secret, probably number one of early stage companies, seed stage companies. Mm-hmm. Aligning the interests of the early team is extremely important.
Right. So you know, I totally agree, and it's important to remind entrepreneurs that you don't need all the investors to agree with you. You need to find one that really transmits on the same wavelength as you do. Okay, you have to find the right partner for your company. But it's so much easier said than done, because after you've met with 50 VCs and heard no 50 times, and then the 51st tells you yes, but I have these conditions, and these conditions don't really align with your beliefs, it's very, very hard not to be tempted to say, okay, we'll do that. That's fine. And just ignore the fundamental difference in what you want the company to look like 3 years from now or 5 years from now, and what they do. So it's much easier said than done, but I think it's a very important point to bear in mind when going to raise money for your new company.
I agree to what you say. When we are talking about raising money, 2000, 2006 were different times technology-wise. And you recently raised a seed round with your company. What search strategy do you recommend to founders, early stage entrepreneurs these days? I mean, the technology level has advanced tremendously in the last two decades. So we have a lot going on LinkedIn, on the internet. What is your approach when you try to build your funnel? How do you approach searching for VCs these days?
Okay. So nowadays, I think it's much easier. So you have resources like PitchBook and others that provide information on a lot of VCs. One tool that I find extremely helpful is actually a tool by NFX, which is called Signal, and it's open to the whole community. I think the address is signal.nfx.com or something like that. But if you Google Signal and NFX, you'll find it, and it connects entrepreneurs with investors, and it has a very extensive roster of investors and many parameters about them. So you can look up which areas they've invested in before. You can look up the range of checks that they write. What's their sweet spot in terms of ticket size? What stages they invest in. So you can really run searches that come up with investors who are most suitable for what you're currently looking for and in building the lead list for our seed round. I heavily relied on Signal for building that, and it's been very useful. Another thing, it also shows you, it has this kind of a social network feature built in, so you connect with people you already know, whether it's investors or other entrepreneurs, or other people which have Signal accounts, and it shows you what's the introduction paths that you can get to certain investors. So if you know someone who knows that investor, you can ask for an introduction. So I think it's somewhat like LinkedIn, but specifically useful for investments and has many features that are very, very helpful. In general, NFX has invested a lot in creating tools for the startup community, that they rely heavily on technology, and they're doing a great job in creating tools. Many of them are internal for the NFX portfolio companies, but Signal is a good example. Yeah, that's it.
That's a great point. I was not aware of that. It's there is, I think, a similar app with a similar name on the market, but it's different. It's not Signal app. This which is comparable to WhatsApp. So it's from NFX Ventures.
Yeah, that's something else. Yeah, Signal is name used a lot.
And this one is dedicated to Israel, New York City, Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco.
Yeah, I think it's pretty global, but you have London there and you have Canada, etc. But of course, there's a overrepresentation probably for US and some. There might be some overrepresentation for Israel, because NFX does have offices in Israel, of course, as well as the US.
The European Union citizen in me would say it cannot be international because there is nothing from the European Union in there. So it's maybe a reason also for our European VCs to reach out to NFX and Signal and to
compare. Yeah, definitely. I'm sure it can be extended to include many more European VCs.
I just imagine that when someone then hears the episode, listens to the episode and finds in this app and wants to reach out to VCs, works through 200 or 300 investors from the United States, and then comes the big day. The first one agrees to a meeting in person. They board a plane, fly over to somewhere in the United States. And then the question that pops up in my mind is, are there any cultural differences that you see between the world in Europe, Asia? So when we look at the Mediterranean area, for example, compared to the US area, is there anything that you recommend to founders who reach out to US-based investors to have in mind when they start with their presentation and when they start engaging with US-based investors? Are there any cultural specialities?
Yeah, there probably are. But again, I wouldn't consider myself an expert on cultural differences. I would generally...
From what you experienced.
Yeah, sure. I would generally recommend trying to be yourself. Okay, so try to be comfortable with the situation and, dress reasonably. Don't overdress. Don't underdress like I did today. Come ready to really have an open discussion of what you're presenting. So plan on leaving time for discussion I think at least in the US, they're very used to people from all over the world. So don't think too much about cultural differences. I think it's different in Asia, but it's also it's beginning to change. I've raised money in mainland China and Hong Kong, and you see more of a global approach now. I'm hearing that Japan is still much more conservative and sticks to their habits, etc. But I've never raised money there. And with Europe, again, it's we are all a global village now. So meeting with investors in Asia and US, of course, Israel and in Europe, I didn't find something that struck me as really a crucial cultural difference that should be a major consideration. Just concentrate on the business, on the vision, and on being open for new ideas and discussions.
Yeah, I hope it stays that way. That we are a global village and don't go in another direction. It's really great to see how the cultures merged together in the last 1.5 decades.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at your website, let's go to your company. What's the big problem that your company wants to solve?
So Pangea does the precision oncology. Precision oncology is really a fascinating area. And as you know, there has been a tremendous revolution in oncology over the last 20 years. So 20 years ago, if someone had a non-resectable cancer, so cancer that cannot be just removed completely through operation, if it progressed beyond that stage, it was basically a death sentence. So you would be fighting for time, but there was no way to cure people of cancer unless you caught it very, very early and then either removed it surgically or managed to ablate it with radiation or something like that. Beyond a certain stage, it was hopeless. And over the last 20 years, there's been a revolution with targeted therapies that target specific vulnerabilities that are unique to cancer cells and do not occur in healthy tissues. And these are novel generations of therapies beyond the traditional chemotherapies, which are sometimes much, much more effective. And beginning around 20 years ago, we've seen cases of people with advanced cancer where therapy actually leads to complete elimination of the disease for prolonged periods of time. It may reoccur, but you can actually get complete remission just by using drugs. And this is, of course, amazing. But if we look at the situation nowadays, 20 years after these first miracles began to happen, it's still applicable to only a very small fraction of the cancer patient population. So the current dogma for precision oncology and for targeted therapies relies on finding specific actionable mutations. Sometimes it's different kinds of genetic events like fusions or translocations, but let's use the term mutations. If a patient is lucky enough to have one of these mutations in his or her tumor, then we can match a particular drug that targets this mutation, this vulnerability of the tumor, and sometimes it's very effective. But there are two problems with this approach. The first is that these actionable mutations are actually pretty rare. So in around 8 to 9 out of every 10 patients, you wouldn't find any actionable mutations. You would find many mutations, but most of them are variants with unknown clinical significance. Okay, so we don't know what to do with them. We know that they occur, but we have nothing to offer these patients. And the other problem is, even if you're lucky enough to have one of these actionable mutations found, it's not as if they are perfect biomarkers. So if you'll get a drug matched based on such a mutation, it will only work in some patients, 30 to 40% of the patients. So the bottom line is that only 5, 6, maybe 7% of the whole patient population actually benefit from all these wonderful new drugs that have been developed in the last 20 years. And this gap is a huge gap, because we found ways to treat cancer effectively using drugs, but we are only able to do that for a small fraction of the patient population. And the question is, how do we bring it to the vast majority of the patients? And Pangea's approach to that question is quite unique. So instead of looking at the DNA and looking for the defects in the genetic code, what we're doing is looking elsewhere. We are looking not at the code, but at the way this code is actually translated into proteins in the cell. Because when one examines cancer cells, you discover that although cancer is really characterized by mutations, by genetic aberrations, the most remarkable characteristic of cancer cells is actually expression abnormalities. So in every cancer cell, you find hundreds and even thousands of genes that are normally coded. So there's no defect in the code. The DNA is intact, but they are abnormally expressed. They are either very significantly overexpressed or very significantly underexpressed. And Pangea's whole approach focuses on harnessing these expression abnormalities in order to attack cancer cells and spare normal, healthy cells. Okay, so that's the basic premise. And based on that, we managed to develop tools both for improvement of the drug development process, so develop more effective drugs more quickly, more accurately, and for matching both existing and novel drugs to the patients in a more accurate manner. So finding the best drug for each patient in a highly personalized manner. So that's the story in a nutshell. That's the problem. That's the direction for solution.
How high is your success rate then in finding the right patients for the right treatment? You mentioned before that with this new personalized medicine that appeared 2 decades ago, only a very, very small fraction, a very narrow fraction of patients qualified for that. Mm-hmm. When companies work with your solutions, do you have a number? How much bigger the how should I call it, the success rate then is of finding
sure.
good patients?
Yeah, sure. So you know that the challenge here is measuring it properly and finding sufficient data to accurately estimate. What we've done, and this has been published in top journals like Cell and Nature, etc., is we looked at retrospective data of patients who received targeted therapies, where there was follow-up, and we knew first of all which therapy the patient received. We knew did they respond to the therapy or not, and we also knew the molecular characteristics, so the DNA and RNA sequencing based on which we compute our Enlight matching score. Enlight is the name of our platform, and the Enlight matching score is a score that measures to which extent a particular drug is expected to be efficacious for a very particular tumor. So all in all, we've done that on around 1,500 patients from a couple of dozen different clinical trials where we had this retrospective data. And what we see is the following, and that's from many different cancer types and many different drugs that these patients have received. So first of all, for over 85-90% of the patients, Enlight does find some drugs with a high Enlight matching score. So it almost always finds a matched therapy for a patient in the vast majority of the cases. And for patients who actually received an Enlight matched drug, the response rates were significantly higher than the baseline in those clinical trials. So we published that last year in Cell, and there this year there's been publication in BioArchive, which is hopefully going to be published in a top line journal in the next couple of months, that shows that these results hold on a very wide range of therapies and cancer types. So altogether, it leads to a several-fold increase in the number of patients that can benefit from existing therapies. So that's the personalized medicine angle thing. But there's also the ability to find the right patient populations for novel drugs that are being developed, and that these are collaborations that we are engaged in with pharma companies and biotech companies.
It's a great opportunity for me to challenge what I learned about cancer research in the last years. I remember that, to what you said, I remember it was, I think, a conversation from a couple of years ago where someone said that 99% of all drug development in cancer fails in clinics. So it's a very, very high failure rate compared to other indications. And one of the reasons is that when the research, the R&D companies and teams don't find the right patients, then a probably effective and safe drug, relatively safe drug when we talk about cancer, fails in clinics, which could have benefited other patients. So it's really a huge problem in the pharma industry to find the right patient population. And when I get you right, this is the problem that you address when we look at companies who are doing R&D in cancer. Did I understand you right?
Yeah, you understood perfectly right. So I'm not sure about the exact numbers, but definitely most novel oncology clinical trials fail, and they usually fail relatively late. So in stages 2 and 3, And this is indeed a huge cost burden, and you're correct that they mostly fail not because the drug doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It does, however, it's hard to predict which would be the exact patients who would benefit from it and which wouldn't. So we have many new drugs that are effective sometimes. And if we only knew to better select the patients for which the drugs are effective, we could have gotten approval for them. But if you do an all-comer trial, you would often get a low success rate, and you wouldn't be able to prove any benefit over standard of care. Now, you know, the pharma companies, they face a dilemma, because if you come to them with a good biomarker, you can narrow down the patient population but obtain a much higher success rate versus an all-comer trial. But you would succeed in the trial, but you narrow down a priori your patient population. So traditionally, pharma companies didn't like biomarker-based trials. They didn't like to a priori narrow down the patient population. But in recent years, more and more of the trials are actually biomarker-based. And what Pangea offers is a better way, more accurate way, to develop such biomarkers that would guide the trials. And actually, we are working to expand the patient population, because right now many drugs are going into trials based on some genomic mutation. And as we saw, these are not great biomarkers. So you narrow it down to some mutation, you have your 30 or 40% success rate within that patient population. But if we were able to say, okay, take only half of the population of patients with this mutation, but there's also a 10 or 15 or 20% of the patient populations without that mutation that you could also target, that actually leads to a larger patient population with higher accuracy. So that's the kind of work that we're doing, developing more accurate biomarkers that would allow you both to and larger patient population and get higher success rates in the clinical trials. And we are hoping that this would really lead to more and better approvals in the upcoming years.
I hope so, because I think there is only little room for a second trial. So when a clinical trial failed, it's really difficult to, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's in a private or company or in a big pharma company. It's really difficult then to convince investors or also the boards in bigger corporations mm-hmm. to reinvest in another trial because it was the wrong patient population.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's very, very hard to salvage failed trials. So it's of crucial importance to get it right the first time. Then you can expand to larger populations, etc. But I think it would mean a lot to the whole industry if we could get more successful first trials, and because right now we're losing many potentially beneficial drugs.
That's true. When I think about the R&D value chain from research in research organizations, doesn't matter if it's universities or if it's pharma companies, up to clinical phase 3 or 4 studies, what is the ideal point to approach you? I mean, your team might be a potential partner, as far as I understood, for any corporation who is attempting to develop drugs against cancer. Mm-hmm. What is your ideal client in that area? How early can it be?
It can be very early. So Enlight is a very, very unique platform in that respect. And to understand why it is so unique, we'll have to dive a little bit deeper into the technology, but I can easily describe what's the difference. You know, there are many AI companies out there which are able to develop good biomarkers if you have sufficient data. So the normal approach would be, let's say you have a drug, I don't know, I'm making up an example for lung cancer, and you tried it out on 1,000 different lung cancer patients, and it worked for 300 of these 1,000 patients, and the other 700 did not respond to the drug. Now, if you collected a lot of data, you collected the demographics, of course, and you also collected, you did DNA sequencing, and you did messenger RNA sequencing to measure the expression, the transcriptomics, you can take all of that data for each patient. As features for supervised learning algorithm, and you can take the outcome, responder versus non-responder, as a label, and you can train a machine learning algorithm, be it a support vector machine or a logistic regression model or a deep learning model, depending on your taste and the specifics of the problem. And you can train it to classify patients based on, let's say, demographics plus genomics plus transcriptomics into responders versus non-responders. And you can get really good models that way. But there is a problem. Usually you just don't have that data. Definitely you don't have that data when you're developing a new drug that hasn't yet been tried on even a single patient. But even with drugs that have been that passed already phase 1 or phase 1/2, you only have a handful of patients. So numbers are just not big enough to train that type of model and obtain such AI-based accurate biomarkers. So the uniqueness about what we do in Pangea is we actually broke up the biomarker development process into two distinct stages. The first stage asks a very general question. Basically, what we are asking is, if we hit a particular target, if we have a drug, let's say, that inhibits a specific gene, there are many other genes that have functional interactions with that target gene. And the state of these genes, we call them the functional environment of the target gene. The state of this functional environment would determine if the treatment would be more effective, or on the other hand, they might cause the cancer cell to overcome the attack, to overcome the treatment, find other pathways to bypass what we are trying to block, for example. Okay, so our focus is understanding this functional neighborhood of the genes which are the drug targets. And the way we break down this question is, first we ask, can we identify those genes which are functionally related in a strong manner to the target gene? So for any pair of genes in the genome, we can ask, are these related in a functional manner? So just to give an example of such a functional relationship, one famous example is a relationship called synthetic lethality. And synthetic lethality is a great example of many things. Among other things, it's a great example of how biologists give complicated names to simple phenomena, because it simply means that gene A and gene B, none of them is individually essential, but you have to have at least one of them functioning properly. So if you lose gene A, the cell still functions. If you lose gene B, the cell still functions. But if you lose A and B simultaneously, that would lead to cell death. So for example, we can find such synthetic lethal interactions, and we find them based on a lot of in vitro data. Okay, so data from cell cultures that have been subject to genetic manipulations, to drug trials, so adding drug to the dish and seeing how it affects the cells, et cetera, et cetera. And we've got a lot of clinical data, so we have those immense databases of clinical data and in vitro data and phylogenetic data, based on which we can find the synthetic lethal interaction and other types of interactions. Synthetic dosage lethality and synthetic rescue interactions, and we are able to draw these large maps of functional interactions within the human genome. We call them the genetic social graphs, so to speak, because that they describe some relationship between the genes. And the important thing is that this stage does not rely on any information which is specific to one cancer type or to a specific therapy. So this is the heavy lifting of our AI machinery, and it's not drug specific nor cancer specific. And in the next stage, we can look at the activation pattern of a particular patient. We can look at their DNA and RNA sequencing results, and superimposing that on our pre-existing map of interactions, we can come up with the NLight matching score. And the nice thing is that we do that and we don't need any specific clinical data for the drug that is being assessed. So NLight is able to create biomarkers for completely novel drugs or for drugs that are already that already exist but have only been tried on a handful of patients so far. And all of our results in the various papers are based on this methodology, which was never trained on the specific scenario on which it is tested. So this is a very, very significant differentiating factor, which allows us to really work with drug developers starting at very early stages of the development. So in theory, you can apply it when the drug is still on the drawing board before a microgram of it has ever been produced, and anticipate in advance which patients would benefit from it. And not supposing that you know well enough what genes it's going to target or what proteins it's going to target. I hope that's been clear enough. It's a a little bit complicated.
It sounds great to me. I mean, I think maybe it's a bad joke, but I had in mind it's the matchmaking service then for drugs and patients, basically, so you can swipe through and find the right one.
It is in a sense, and really, Enlight produces reports which scan through over 80 different drugs for each patient, and they prioritize them by their Enlight matching score. Of course, eventually you have to make the clinical decision, and the oncologist should take the Enlight report into consideration together with a lot of other clinical information. But I think it's it can be a very useful tool, and it has actually been already proven in the clinic. We've produced Enlight reports over the last 2 years to many patients with severe and complicated cancers, and there have been quite a few success stories already, and each of them is really a great joy. And we are about to embark in very large scale prospective clinical trials with Enlight, both in the US together with the National Cancer Institute, part of the NIH in Bethesda, and also in Israel with the Rambam Hospital in Haifa, and soon we're hoping to start trials also in Sheba, which is the largest hospital in Israel, and Hadassah in Jerusalem, which is another very large hospital here in Israel. So 2023 is going to see a lot of clinical trial activity around Enlight.
And hopefully successful. It would be great to increase the success rate for both, I mean, drug developers, but also for the patients. I think this is, in the end of the day, the ultimate goal, to help the patients find the right treatment and successfully fight off cancer.
Right, definitely.
What about the business model in your area? Let's start with drug development. Are you offering your solutions as a service, or are you participating in the clinical trial? What are your thoughts about the business model of Pangea?
Yes, so we're not thinking about Pangea as a services company. The way we see ourselves is really as true partners for the drug developers. So we like to take a share of the risk and also a share of the upside. We try to be flexible and really find the right business structure to collaborate with our partners, whether they are commercial drug developers or academic institutions. We have lots and lots of academic collaborations, both here in Israel and a lot of them in the US. And we are now talking to a couple of European partners. We're looking to establish also research collaborations in Europe. So it's pretty varied. Really, the idea is to get involved early and become an integral part of the drug development process, bringing our unique capabilities to this process, and hopefully significantly improving the results.
So you become a long-term partner then of the development, in the development process.
Yeah, definitely. That's the approach.
On one hand, on the other hand, I hope I understood it right from your explanation, you might be also a potential partner for cancer hospitals who have cancer patients in the hospitals and want to screen the market for the best solutions for their patients. What are your thoughts about the business model in that area?
So I right now we are offering this service completely pro bono. So we're not performing the sequencing ourselves, but we are happy to run an Enlight report for any patient who has already undergone RNA sequencing and potentially also DNA sequencing. But it's the mRNA sequencing, that's the essential and unique data source for the ENLITE analysis. And we are doing it for a while now in Israel, and we've recently extended that to the US. And as I said, we are expecting to begin a large-scale clinical trial around that together with the NCI, with the National Cancer Institute, in the fall. And eventually, I think there is a huge commercial potential there, but we're not there yet, and I wouldn't like to speculate on what exactly the monetization model would be around that. There are many different ways to go around it. It's very important for us to bring this solution to the market because beyond its obvious economic value, it's first and foremost a solution that can really make a significant impact on patients' lives. So I'm sure we'll find a way to also make money out of that down the road, and we're definitely looking at different solutions, but let's first get it out there and get many patients tested and prove the value at a large scale, and I'm sure that the economic success would follow eventually.
That's true. What about your team? How big is Pangea currently, and who are the team players?
Okay, so Pangea is around 20 people at the time. We're still a small company, but we have a very, very unique and a very strong team. The company is heavily oriented towards R&D, so most of the team is a very, very strong R&D team, and we have many PhDs and master degree holders, both in biology and in computer science, machine learning, data science, statistics, etc. So we span a range of specialties that cover precision oncology from multiple angles, and we've been really fortunate to recruit such wonderful people, and I think it's really the most important thing for Pangea to be able to continue to recruit such amazing people to our team.
Sounds amazing. We're coming to the end of our conversation. Let me ask you two final questions. One is, what do you need currently? What are you looking for? What is your next step that someone from the audience might help you with?
Well, first of all, every startup company needs more money. It's trivial. It's obvious. We will need more money. By the way, we haven't released that yet, so I won't provide too many details. But I can tell you that we've recently increased our seed funding by another $5 million, bringing the total raised so far to over $12 million. And this was important for us, especially right now, because as I said before, it looks like we are during a somewhat of a downturn in the economy. No one knows how long it would last, but it's not as easy to raise money today as it was 6 or 9 months ago. So this gives us really nice security and safety net, and enables us to continue expanding for a long period of time. The other thing that we are looking for, collaborations, and so especially to the European audience, we don't have as many European collaborations right now as we would like to have. And we really are looking for partners in Europe, both hospitals and universities, and of course, pharma companies. So do feel free to reach out. We're actively seeking collaboration with organizations from Europe, and we would love to discuss the possibilities of collaboration.
That's great. So my final question is, you're an experienced founder and you've built multiple companies to success and also are now in the process of building the next great company in the life science industry. When a young founder approaches you, a first-time founder approaches you and asks for advice, and you only have 1 minute to give one advice, what would it be?
Well, first of all, I usually try to have more than 1 minute. So I don't believe in miracle answers, and really every case is different, and the challenges that every young entrepreneur or beginning entrepreneur, doesn't have to be a young, faces are different. So I wouldn't try to come up with a one size fits all advice, that entrepreneurs are always welcome to get in touch, and I try to find time to meet and discuss and help to the limited ability I have.
That's a great answer. Tuvik, did I miss anything? Is there any topic open that you would like to talk about, or any question that you want me to ask you?
No, it's been a pretty long meeting and very enjoyable one, and definitely a thorough one. So I would really like to take the opportunity to thank you again for inviting me on this podcast, and it's been wonderful. Thanks a lot, and keep on this wonderful work.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation as well, and it was great having you on the show. I wish you and your team success and luck in the coming years, and I'm pretty sure that you improve cancer research.
I hope so too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye-bye, Christian. Bye.
Did you enjoy the episode? Then please subscribe and follow the channel.